us. We are going to try this new format today, and we thought we might do it every other week. And it's kind of, we want to try and make it a bit more of an open format. So if you've got things you want to say and questions you've got, then, you know, either dive in, you know, tell us in advance of, you know, things that you would like us to talk about, or, you know, as a group, in advance of these sessions. So we plan really to do every other week, something like this. We've called the GDPR radio, but I mean, obviously it's not anything like a radio broadcast. And then every other week, we're going to focus back in on a topic and try and give it some focus. And we thought these sessions might be shorter, so we'll just have to see how they go. So we kind of in our minds thought, well, we might run out of stuff to talk about after half an hour, but that might be unlikely. We'll see how we go on. So I'm Phil Brining from podcast. We're recording it, as you can see from the privacy notice, so that people can access it afterwards if there's anything of any interest that you want to re-listen to. I'm joined by some of my colleagues, Dave and Ollie, who will say hi in a second. And we're just going to, you know, been looking at the news, and we're going to talk about some of the topical stuff and you know, how it applies to us. Dave, Ollie, hello.
Hello, how are you doing?
Yeah, all right. Ollie, hello.
Hi, everyone.
So what have you been doing, Dave? You've been training, have you?
Yeah, I've been training this morning, and I've got a second session this afternoon. just general GDPR training virtually, which is the way of doing things now in a COVID-friendly world, isn't it?
So it's who's the audience?
Housing Association. General training for housing associations on GDPR and information handling.
Right, so just regular employees, not specialists.
Yeah, no, just regular employees. It's I think it's part of their kind of training program, and it's yeah, going well. I was late off the session, unfortunately, which ate into a bit of time, just because the engagement I got. It's always really good when people kind of engage with the material and ask around what they're doing and about things in the news. So it was good to have a nice audience. I would like to get back at it sometimes to do it face to face. I do miss the face to face kind of training. I know virtual is a very good way of doing it, but I do miss the face to face.
The virtual works surprisingly well, actually, except you can't see the body language, so you don't get as much feedback. It's quite hard to do. I tell you what, I was talking to Rob yesterday, one of our sales guys. He's got a client that doesn't like e-learning, but wants to do something kind of e-learning-ish. So we were talking about it, and I suggested that maybe we did something not quite as loose as this, but like this, where we pick it. You know, they've got eight topics they want us to talk about: records posting activities, legitimate interest assessments, DPIAs, special category personal data, and a few others. So I said to her, well, why don't we have a bash at doing some like 10-minute videos? We're working through a set of slides, so we might be talking about special category data, but then rather than it being like a tutor kind of running through a slide, it would be more interactive. So it might be us talking about, you know, where did they come from? Why are they a special category? What about sensitive stuff like financial information? You know, how do we have to treat it differently? You know, reducing access. I want to have a go at that, because I think that could be really, really useful. You know, and if we do it properly, then it could be something that multiple clients might be able to use.
I really like the idea. Some of the training that I deliver, I try to personalise to the organisation, so using their slides and demonstrating their policies and procedures and things. But I like the approach of having it as a kind of a fluid conversation around a specific topic. It doesn't necessarily have to be aimed at a general audience, but it could be aimed at a governance team or additional support for the DPO on some technical matters. And to deliver that in a range of different formats, because not everybody likes the classroom learning, not everybody likes reading and trying to understand stuff. And for those that learn better through the audio element, it may really work for some of the clients. And especially if you're doing it, limiting it to 10, 15 minutes as sections they could listen to over lunch, or in the car or on the commute home, I think it could get quite a lot of traction with it.
Well, we'll have to have a go at that, because it's tricky, you know, when you, as you know, because you've done it, you're delivering the training, and you keep having to, have you got any questions, you know, and you know, you don't get much feedback often from a group of employees, do you? But what you would get is feedback from your colleagues. If you, me and Ollie were doing it, does that make sense? You know, would you put it a different way? I think, anyway, we'll have a go at it, because I think it could be really quite fun to do and useful.
And that's why I miss the delivering workshops in the face-to-face format, because you can set tasks to kind of go right in pairs. Can you think about this? And then you set a task for 5-10 minutes, maybe 5 minutes, 10 minutes, maybe a bit long. But it gives you a chance to then go and pick on different groups and kind of work your way around the table to have kind of interaction, but on a 2-to-1 or 3-to-1 process as you kind of move around the table. When you're doing it virtually and you're kind of asking people to engage, you then go back into the old format. If you're not careful, even face-to-face, you can sometimes fall into the format of if you ask a question to everybody, then you get predominantly the stronger characters always responding and interacting. Whereas if you set people in pairs, it makes a weaker party have to respond. And then if you can't pick on them personally, then they've got to interact with you as well. So it's horses for courses, I think.
Yeah, well, if anybody's listening and think it's a crazy idea, let us know. And if you think it's a good idea, let us know as well. Wally, what have you been up to then? You say you've been busy with lots of bits and bobs.
Yeah, so usual support desk work, some compliance work for my clients. And then I mentioned before a few of the people joined a little earlier that my big piece of work for the week is putting together a proposal for the marketing department of one of my clients in terms of proposing a process for them collecting and managing photographs for marketing purposes.
Right.
Part of the reason that it's difficult is that it's a product which is primarily aimed at children. So lots of photographs of kids and how we actually manage that compliantly. How do we make it work? And it's difficult. Let's put it that way.
Well, this isn't. Same client needs to probably be aware that the Irish are in looking like they're going to introduce something similar to our age appropriate design code of conduct legislation around children and children's data. I read today.
Yeah, well, we're currently we've just started the DPIA aimed at addressing the age appropriate design code of practice this month, so that's underway currently.
Yeah,
as I'm doing.
But they know they operate all over Europe, don't they? So they just have to be mindful that other European states are taking the UK's lead and introducing legislation around it.
No, definitely.
Codes of practice around it. So, anyway, did you see, kind of on with the news, I mean, there's quite a lot of stuff been going on again this week. The ICO, interestingly, fined a food company, Muscle Foods, did you see that, for failing to meet the requirements of the soft opt-in under the PECA? So they sent out enormous number of emails, like 135 million emails. But anyway, they only fined them £50,000. That actually seemed to have done quite a good job at, working with the ICO. When you read the monetary penalty notice, you know, they were supplying lots of information and trying to be really helpful. But the ICO has basically said, you know, you didn't get proper consent and, you know, you were selling dissimilar products, didn't they? So they failed at every hurdle, all the 3 points to make soft opt-in a soft opt-in. They didn't meet those, did they? What did you see in that day?
What I took out of it, I got those points, but what I took out of it really was as a defence to doing something wrong, to really overly engage and to try to use it as a kind of mitigation to the ICO, not necessarily saying we didn't do it and try to back out of it, but kind of going, look, we got it wrong, how can we help you? What can you advise us to, how can we work with you to correct this kind of thing? In that sense. And the reason why I was saying that is because it just relates to a client I'm working with at the moment. I had a personal data breach following a subject access request where additional information on unrelated individuals was disclosed. And they were asking me on advice in relation to what do they need to do now going forward. And I said, the easiest approach is to hold your hands up, acknowledge it's gone wrong. Let's not try and bluff and bluster our way through it. Let's not do a bit of a Boris. In that kind of sense, acknowledge it's gone wrong. Acknowledge the steps you've taken to investigate the incident. And as part of that, to identify the fact that you realised that you were falling short in some areas and have appointed a consultancy firm to work with you to correct the errors. Now, that might not necessarily stop the ICO being interested, but it goes somewhere to showing the fact that you've started the process of trying to right the wrongs.
Mm. Now, what did you make of Google promising to drop personalised ad tracking, both of you? I mean, I've read lots of stuff on this, and it seems that everyone's very suspicious. Well, they're stopping personalised ad tracking because they've got other ways of doing it, and they're just trying to block third parties doing the same thing. Am I being overly cynical here?
I mean, there's certainly a line in that. So the comparison that you can draw, which is another development that's closely related in the sector, and one I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, is that Apple are taking a relatively similar approach to phone applications in terms they're looking to introduce more privacy-focused initiatives to stop cross-platform and cross-app tracking.
I remember you mentioned this, yeah.
Yeah, which is another one of the things that Google are also looking at. And again, in the same way, the response from app developers across the industry has been very cynical, which is that, well, realistically, they're trying to muscle us out. And as some of you may know, Apple have already faced quite a lot of criticism in terms of how they operate their app store. But so one of the things they're looking to do as part of that is that they are basically introducing a system where you can still carry out app attribution, app installation attributions and tracking across different applications and platforms, but basically you have to go through Apple to do it. And I think that's more or less what one of the approaches anyway that Google are looking to take with this. I've read into it quite sort of extensively. I don't know to what depth you went into, Phil. I mean, it's very technical, some of it, in terms of what they're actually looking to do in this Privacy Sandbox initiative. I don't claim to be
No, I probably didn't go into it as much detail as you did, to be honest, by the sounds of it.
But it's, yeah, it's extremely complex. I mean, one of the things that they're looking to do as part of it is they're introducing a new API, which basically looks to, instead of identifying individuals and their preferences, looks to group people by broader interests so that individuals themselves aren't identifiable and targeted. Instead, they sort of build broader interest groups, which they then target ads at. That's one of the things they're doing out of, I think, about a dozen different initiatives that they're all bringing under this one umbrella. Yeah. It's very interesting, but I think the cynical response to it is probably not entirely unfounded. But
So we're not going to see the end of it. We're just going to see probably a change of direction. I mean, maybe they're trying to outmaneuver this e-privacy regulation, which is now looking like it's going to come in the next few months.
Yeah, well, a lot of these developments definitely seem to be working their way around e-privacy, the new e-privacy or even current existing ones. So the one I mentioned before that Apple have implemented basically allows them to get around having to comply with the PECA rules on cookies and similar technologies, because technically it no longer relies on reading information on a user device or writing it to the device, so they can get around that and they can still do high level tracking. Yeah. So I think you're spot on in that regard.
Rick's raised an interesting question or point rather that some of these providers are publishing their DPAAs, you know, to help people make an informed decision. He's saying that the one for G Suite was really useful. That, in my experience, Google actually been quite good. Their privacy guys have been quite good. I've spoken to them at conferences and that, and they're usually quite good. They don't seem like, you know, they've got an awful lot to hide, but maybe they're just in such a dominant market position they don't have to hide it because people still use their services. And we've got to do one, haven't we? We've got a client that wants to do us a thorough review of how they use Teams across the world and the 3,500 employees to go and have a, you know, look at what they're doing with it. And, you know, when you start thinking about Teams, it's not just video calls, is it? It's the integrations into SharePoint, integrations into other services like Stream, you know, it's integrations into Outlook. So, you know, it requires a really good technical understanding. And Rick said they don't use G Suite, but actually it's useful to pull these documents off and have a look at the topics that you discuss and, you know, how they're structured. And, you know, from that we can learn, can't we, and maybe fine-tune our own highly technical DPAAs.
No, absolutely. And I mean, related to that to a degree, I don't know if either of you seen this, I think it's this week or at least quite recently, the ICO's new toolkit on data analytics. Which I had a bit of a play around with this morning. I mean, it's primarily focused by the looks of it on gearing up towards the use of AI increasingly or advanced algorithms in data analytics. But I thought it was it's quite good. I mean, it's not super applicable to us, and generally what it does is just basically redirect you to other parts of the guidance. But as an introductory step, it could be quite useful.
Yeah. I mean, do you think, Rick, question, do you think the ICO could ever consider a public register of these kinds of documentations? I can't see the ICO being so, I mean, they are pretty good, but I can't see them being so proactive as to do that. I mean, somebody else might do it and compile them and you know, put them together in a searchable database. Well, the ICO public domain. Can't remember if they are or not. But I would see the ICO putting out the supplementary, essential European guarantees, probably as kind of like this is a reusable document. But I'm not sure that they would do on individual DPAs. Don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, it's a tricky one, isn't it? Because it's it's a good thought. I think it's a good thought as to whether you could have a public document. But I guess it'd be similar saying, could you have a public place for large organisations like that to put their processing activities, like data processing agreements?
Oh, do you mean like the old register? How we used to have in the good old days.
So it's a nice start. I think whether practically it'll work, whether you'd get anybody with the interest of actually trying to take it forward and drive it, either as a paid revenue stream or as a non-paid revenue stream. I think there may be some practicalities around it. And then it also would no doubt be heavily disclaimed saying, it's not been assessed and addressed. That kind of stuff.
Yeah. I mean, it was in a way that, I'm surprised that ROPAs aren't meant to be in the public domain. It's the obvious thing to do, isn't it? Put your records processing activities out there so people can get the level of detail that they want. I was surprised that the GDPR didn't go that far, to be honest.
Well, they're a core document. They're kind of a public document because the ROPAs under the GDPR is replacing, in essence, so it came from trying to address the old need to register, wasn't it, with the ICO and that kind of stuff. So there's no reason why it couldn't be a public document. I just think the GDPR wants a lot more detail in there. In that sense, you could say it's a public document. We're just not going to make it public, so you can have it if you ask for it. We'll demonstrate parts of it if you ask for it.
Yeah, I was completing an attestation of compliance for a customer the other day for PCI DSS, and I thought, why don't we have one of these for data protection? Why are we not required when we pay our controller fee to attest to our compliance? I promise I am doing my filling in these. That would be a useful thing to do, wouldn't it? Because in the ICO, you've got more leverage if you found not to be compliant. Well, you attested to compliance, and maybe the accountability would be, and we have external audits to demonstrate, that it's an independent assessment. That would be that'd be a great regime, wouldn't it? I wonder why they don't go that far. See, I'm getting on my wishful thinking again. I have to take my rotation
again. I agree with what you say. I think you sound like you're in an interview for the Elizabeth's job. So I'd just be cautious that if anybody else is listening and thinking about being a potential competitor for the role, that you might be giving your game away. But it's
all right. Yeah. Speaking of that, I don't know if everyone's aware, but the ICO's conference this year in April is going to be digital, and therefore the number of seats aren't restricted, so it's usually a pretty good affair, isn't it, to go to and attend, and it's digital this year. You can dip in and dip out, but there's a page now where you can register, and then they give you a link to all the stuff. But I would encourage you to do it. If you go year after year after year after year, some of it is a bit same old, but it's actually quite good to spend the day out of the office, in this environment, tons of other privacy practitioners listening to Elizabeth herself speak and others. I always find it quite a motivational day when I manage to get a ticket.
Yeah, sometimes you struggle to get tickets to attend, but I've always found it quite useful.
Yeah. Did you see that the Irish law, I didn't realise this, Irish law apparently doesn't recognise third parties' rights to contracts at all as a concept. And therefore, I read a news article that the new proposed standard contractual clauses can't be used in Ireland because Irish law doesn't allow for third parties to have rights under contracts. So what the article was saying is that if you've got an Irish processor, for instance, like Microsoft or Apple or Google or lots of American tech firms, they would have to have standard contractual clauses applicable in other European member state law. So Dutch law, for instance, they're like some kind of complicated three-way step. Well, that's a bit of a oversight, isn't it? You'd have thought that they'd have thought about that before they launched these new SCCs. Did you see that?
I'd heard a bit about it. I don't know if Ollie's read into it. I've heard a little bit about it. I've not really particularly looked into it, but it would seem rather an oversight at this point. Ollie, do you have any comments on that, or are you not as up on it as Phil?
No, I'll be honest. I'd heard about it, but I've not read into it in depth. It is quite surprising, though, you have to say, and I think you touched on a good point, Phil, that I mean, even some of my clients have decided to establish, you know, subsidiaries in Ireland as a result of all of this, sometimes for other reasons. For instance, I have a client who deal in intellectual property, and they've had to register a subsidiary in Ireland to be able to register and manage patents with the European Intellectual Property Office. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, no, definitely interesting. That's thrown up a whole can of worms, really. But, yeah, bizarre oversight in that capacity.
Yeah, interesting. Did you see that Spain's been fined €15 million for failing to implement the Law Enforcement Directive?
Yeah, I did see that.
Yeah,
I did see that, which is, considering the sort of how proactive the AEPD are, that is quite ironic, I suppose.
Well, I thought they're obviously now the bad boys and girls of Europe, whereas we used to be in the past, because we got infraction proceedings for not implementing the old directive proper, didn't we, under the Data Protection Act 98. That rumbled on for years.
Oh, it did. I remember that going on for a bit.
Yeah. So what have you seen there? I mean, I've been rabbited on, haven't I? But what have you seen then that's been useful this week?
I tell you what, on the other scale from that fine you've just mentioned, Phil, on a much smaller, more macro level, one that sort of caught my eye this morning on my daily enforcement tracker rounds, which I thought was quite amusing, is that a private individual in Germany has been fined €200 because he was taking photographs of vehicles and their drivers who he thought were infringing on road, well, were, you know, infringing the laws of the road, road traffic violations. So he's taking pictures of them and submitting them to the local authority, and he's been deemed to be a controller and not have implemented sufficient security measures. So he's been fined €200 for the
I mean, that's no surprise, really, is it? Because, again, the guidance says that if you're repurposing it and using it for that purpose, you are a controller. It's just like that CCTV thing, the Rains case will ever get into.
Yeah, absolutely. I just thought it was quite amusing. But, yeah, no, that's one that jumped out of me. I don't think there's anything else, really, other than that, possibly, for it being quite amusing. And then, as you say, Spain being fined, that's jumped out at me this week.
Yeah, a couple of bits that got me, just, I don't know how much, there's leg room there's to talk about, but there's a couple of things that kind of jumped out at me just before I jump, because I'm going to have to go myself for this training. One, it was reported on the BBC News about Litercam. I don't know if anybody picked up on that CCTV cameras. It's going to be trialled in Maidstone in Kent. That CCTV cameras will soon target individual litterlouts, and it's using AI software to match footage of motorists throwing rubbish out of the cars and then matching it to the number plate and then issuing an automatic fine of £90.
Oh, right.
Which is quite interesting. Along with what was on the news last night in relation to the Amazon shop in London that's just opened, where you can walk in, help yourself, walk out, and it bills that you, well, I think you've got to scan in saying kind of I've entered the building, and it uses a range of CCTV to watch what you're picking up and taking with you. Then it bills you as you leave the shop, but there's no checkouts, as it were.
Sounds like one of those mini bars in a posh hotel where you open the door and it assumes you've taken something out. Little triggers and all the gin bottles and things.
And it makes you wonder, doesn't it, about what happens if you walked in, picked something up and put it down? Does it watch that you put it down and things like that? And would the cameras...
Well, in the wrong place. I'm forever taking stuff and then finding something cheaper or better and putting stuff in the wrong place.
Oh, absolutely. Or whether you've got the kind of safety community partnership kind of setups where you kind of go in, if this guy comes into your shop, go watch him like a hawk, but then tying that to... kind of facial recognition cameras built into Amazon shops, and not only are it's going to charge those that it sees shopping, but it can potentially send a security guard after somebody it doesn't particularly want in there.
Yeah, I tell you, the most boring job when I was a student in London, the most boring job I've ever had, it's the only job I've had where I've longed for my breaks, was working on the security cameras in a massive Tesco store in Beckton. And the only thing, so you could track shoppers, this is back in the 80s, so you could track the shoppers, right, coming in for the car park, and the only thing that made the job interesting was trying to pick someone and follow them right the way down the store. So when they stand under a camera, you're spinning around thinking, oh god, I've lost them, I have to check a different camera. But I tell you what dull work that is. Anyway, enough of that. I tell you what was interesting the other day. I was.
I'm just going to. Don't mean to interrupt. I'm just going to thank everybody for joining in and just hand over to you and Ollie just to manage the rest of the session. I'm going to have to jump for this training. So.
Right. Well, have a cracking weekend, Dave. And if you want to talk about that other stuff after five, then give me a buzz.
Cool. Yeah, we'll do. No worries. Take care for now.
All right. Yeah. Cheers.
Thank you, everybody. Bye bye.
Ollie, one of your clients I was on with the other week about remember the complaint about the tracking pixels in an email.
Yes.
Yeah. So we were on talking about how best to respond, and this guy who's complained to them, there's an article in the Daily Mail that he's written. I fought the spam tests and won, but I had to go to court to do it. So this guy is a serial complainer. He's called Michael Green. And he said he fought a 14-month legal battle after receiving unsolicited emails, but he won. He only got £150 in damages, but he's obviously doing – he's an IT guy. There's people setting out, you know, deliberately to, to sign up to things. He'd signed up to your client's newsletter, made sure he didn't tick any of the opt-ins, read the cookie policy. You must do this on the industrial scale. And now complained. He's asking them for a couple of thousand quid into. Well, you know, one of their IT fellows found this article about this chap on the actually it's not the Mail, it's thisismoney.co.uk. We're going to offer him 550 quid in compensation.
A real Max Schrems, eh? Yes. Battling away, but you know, to a degree, fair enough, and I think it's probably important that there are people like that challenging things. I mean, yeah, it's frustrating for my client and for me, I mean, and the two of us having to deal with it, although having said that, now that this has happened, it's given me a significant amount of leverage in there in terms of saying, well, actually, you know, we have to be careful how we tread when we're conducting activities which invoke PEPA compliance, because clearly things can go wrong, and if they do go wrong, then this is the sort of thing that can happen.
Yeah.
So yeah. That's admittedly in my own sort of self-interested sort of way, that's given me a bit of leverage. But yeah, no, I mean, certainly they're one of those clients, and we've possibly mentioned them before, that really sort of are pushing the boundaries on this sort of stuff. And for the past few weeks, as people are aware, and I've already mentioned, in fact, today, I've been working on their app and how, you know, tracking they wanted to implement on their app might be PECA compliant. It's really sort of the big thing at the minute. But yeah, no, difficult.
I've had five calls this week, spam calls. I haven't had any for ages. I've got five. I've got two on the house phone and three on my mobile, and both numbers are on the TPS. So I've registered a complaint on the ICO's website for each time it happens. I make sure I register a complaint. But remember last week I was saying, yeah, why aren't they pursuing these people under Section 198 Data Protection Act for negligence? And I put that on my form. You should be pursuing these people on Section 198 Data Protection Act for negligence. So hopefully we'll see that they do, and I'll be able to claim that as my good work, my good deed.
As your victory.
My victory, my little victory, a little angry man from Yorkshire, yeah. but the ICO is interesting because they've prosecuted for the second time now under the Computer Misuse Act, didn't they? A member of the employee of the RAC, and they prosecuted and sentenced this individual to a jail sentence for stealing data of the RAC. They also sentenced him to a jail term. The company, the director of the company that was employing him and allowing this person to do it. So, again, that's the first time that a recipient of unlawfully collected data, you know, for negligence, and the fact that they're pursued under the Computer Misuse Act means they can hand down, or they can't, but the courts can hand down a custodial sentence. It's 8 months in prison, suspended for 2 years. So you know, hopefully, you know, they're you know, stepping up and they're beefing up their response. And you know, if people are aware of this, you know, directors of businesses and everybody else that might be affected by that Section 198, you know, hopefully we'll start to see some change in behaviour.
Well, yeah, we've often pushed for that, haven't we? But it's sort of, unfortunately, we haven't really got the precedent to point to and say, look, this can happen. As long as there hasn't been precedent, I think it's one of those things, as a bit of a, you know, a bit of an empty threat almost in that regard. Almost like, because I know and I've seen it recently, sort of people bringing up the fact that you might have individuals who are incorrect recipients of data. So the people who a personal data breach happens, and they're the ones that receive the data, and they sort of start banding around threats saying, well, I'm going to do this with this data that you've incorrectly disclosed. And obviously that in and of itself can be an offence under that same part of the Data Protection Act, isn't it? Retaining data without the consent of a controller, whether knowingly or recklessly. And I've seen that sort of banned around a couple of times, but, you know, obviously it's something which is a real last recourse, I suppose, so there's a reluctance to use it. And again, I think it's probably indicative of the same type of problem. Those offences do exist, and you can be, you know, prosecuted for them, but in practice, is that going to happen?
Well, they've only got limited resources, but I was interested in that you mentioned that Muscle Foods, that Pecker monetary penalty notice. It was only 11 complaints, you know. So out of 135 million calls, there was 11 complaints, and the ICO has acted on it, taken action. So, you know, we've all got to do our bit, I think, and report these non-compliances.
No, you know full well that I do, Phil, don't you worry.
Yeah. And there's a couple of comments. I'm not in touch, we've moved on now, so I can't remember what these comments were about. But Ian's saying that registers will be accessible from public authorities of FOIA. So I guess that's relating to kind of the ROPAs, you know, and us saying, well, they should be in the public domain. So what Ian's saying is that if you're a public authority caught by the Freedom of Information Act, then they probably are. I'm not entirely sure if they're on the publication scheme or if that type of information is caught by FOIA. But yeah, it's a good point. And Tracy's saying that as a charity, whatever we're talking about is too expensive. That might have been this concept of, you know, attestation of compliance. But if I was going to do that, you know, I'd be taking the same approach as the payment industry and saying, well, you know, if you're a level four, you know, a low level, you know, you're small, you don't process much data, you know, nothing too complicated, you can self-assess, but at least there's something that says, you know, we are attesting that we believe we're compliant. And maybe if you're a big organization processing lots of data, or, you know, high risk processing, then maybe, you know, you'd be a requirement to have an external party come in and you know, attest your compliance. But it doesn't have to be an expensive exercise. It's just, I think it would be a good thing to do it, just put, you know, as a senior director or individual in an organization is signing it off, it makes them stop and think, hang on a minute, you know, I'm putting my name down to this, you know, are we compliant? How do I know we're compliant? But just another way.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because, I mean, at the end of the day, you get a degree of that, and because I see a lot of it in sort of trying to conduct due diligence, and you get sort of those organizations who are quite confident in coming forward and saying, well, we are compliant. Or those who are more reluctant to do so. And I've even, you know, I've got a few clients who are processors in all their relationships, so they have to deal with a lot of their clients doing due diligence, and they want, you know, solid assurance that the client is compliant.
Mm.
And potentially, maybe if you then extrapolate that to a high level, as you say, as part of the registration process, maybe you've just got that level of assurance possibly to back it up.
I shall write to the ICO and make a suggestion.
There we go.
We'll probably get something back saying you can get lost and stay in your box, mate. Now, we try and keep these a little bit shorter. Well, I don't know if there's anything that anybody wants to sort of throw into the mix whilst we're having a chat. Dave's already gone through his training. What have you got coming up this week, Ollie? What, next week, sorry?
Very much the same things as this week. Again, by the looks of things, it's same themes, cookies, tracking. I'm helping one of our colleagues with a piece of research, or I have helped him anyway, and he's looking into fingerprinting techniques, which again, a type of tracking, one specifically called out under PECA as requiring consent. But yeah, it's very much a lot of my work sort of focuses in this area at the minute, I have to say. Which I'm not complaining about, let me be clear, I find it fascinating.
It's funny, it's quite good, isn't it? It's a nice area to work. I like the PECA, I think it's a really great area to work in. I think that there's some good rules or some less clear rules, but it's a really interesting, I think it's really interesting working with that. You know,
absolutely. The only issue with the cookie side of thing and the sort of technology side of things is that it's advancing at such a rate now, and they're sort of trying to develop themselves out of having to comply with these rules, that trying to understand actually whether they apply or not is sometimes a full job, full-time job in and of itself.
And that's one of the things I like about working with it, is that it's, you know, it is moving. So our kids are in a moving target, and we have to do lots of reading, lots of interpretation, lots of studying, you know, why the ICO and others have taken certain action. And there's a bit of guidance on it, but not really much, is there?
No, absolutely. And I mean, comparatively, the direct marketing side of things is, I mean, it's a walk in the park compared to the technology side, I find anyway. Especially as I'd potentially argue there's a greater degree of leeway in the direct marketing side of things, what with the soft opt-in.
Yeah.
Although, as I might have mentioned potentially previously, or I've certainly spoken to you about it, Phil, I've seen a number of instances recently, and I maybe don't want to get into this too much, but a number of instances where clients have been misinterpreting the concept of a service message. I don't know if I told you about this, trying to claim that their marketing message is a service message, which is obviously a fundamental misunderstanding of how it works, and sort of trying to look at whether there are any mitigating factors maybe that make it a service message. But no, definitely an area that I like working in.
Yeah, but it's I mentioned it last week, and I haven't done it. I was going to write a blog on, because that point about you know, what constitutes direct marketing. You know, we talked about it last week, didn't we? That the ICO's action that took on these 10 companies since October has all been, you know, if this is contributing at any point to direct marketing, then that activity in itself is direct marketing. So even if you do a survey and then 6 months later you use that information for direct marketing, the ICO would say, well, the survey was used, was being processed for direct marketing purposes. So I think probably need to bash that together with an advice note and a blog, and then distribute it out to anybody that is doing that. Tracy's saying there was an interesting article in the PDP magazine. I don't get the PDP magazine these days. I think it's a really good publication. I don't know why we don't get it. Maybe we didn't subscribe to it. But I haven't seen that, Tracy, but I think it's a great mag. You know, it's a good. I like PDP an awful lot, and I think that you know, that their magazine is very good.
Yeah, I often get it. Well, I get it obviously every month because we do subscribe, because I find it helpful, because it raises awareness on some of the issues that we're talking about today, the new bits in the news and so on. It keeps me up to date, because obviously often in charities, IG is not just our only role. Mm. We have multiple roles within the, you know, various hats. Hence me doing my IOSH training today. But right. Yeah, but it was quite interesting because it's about consent in the UK healthcare sector, because it is quite a challenging area to understand what we need to get direct consent for, where implied consent is okay. You know, because obviously when we see patients for the first time, we're getting that consent to share their data with other healthcare professionals, but it's at what touch points in the service do we need to get further explicit consent. So it's always been a bit of a raw point, and also documenting that has also been a raw point, because they have the conversational consent, and then it's whether that's then documented in patient notes. So sometimes that's an interesting challenge for me. The other thing with our side is access to records. Obviously, we get a number of requests, so dealing with those and looking at patient notes can be challenging. See what people have given consent to share, especially with family members post-death and things like that. So obviously that falls into subject access requests, but even when people are alive, that can be quite a complex area to know what we can share and what we can't.
Yeah, I was going to say actually that it kind of got consent for what is one of the things that I've come across in healthcare. So, you know, there's the medics are focused on, when they talk about consent, it's about consent to, you know, perform a medical procedure. When I'm talking about consent, it's about consent relating to data.
Absolutely. And we had that whole conversation at the, right, you know, a few years ago with, look, you know, when I'm talking from this perspective. Yes, if you want to do that procedural thing, yes, you need a consent form that's accurate for that treatment. But what I'm asking you for is consent for their data to be handled in a specific way. And that's where I think confusion comes in with clinical colleagues sometimes.
Yes.
We sometimes talk across purposes a bit.
Yeah, I have found that. What do you make of the national data opt-in then?
Well, because of our organisation, when we've looked at it, we're a charity, we're a hospice.
Yeah, yeah.
So I've approached them and basically they've said that we don't have to do anything until we're alerted to the fact that somebody wants to actually opt out.
Yeah.
So, which seems slightly odd to me. It's kind of a, and if you don't know that, you don't know that. Do you know what I mean? It was, what questions like do I ask?
It seems like a national secret to me, this national data opt out. I mean, you know, it's not very well publicised, is it?
And I said, oh, do I need to register so that we get the information? It was like, you don't need to register until somebody wants to opt out. Well, how do they know they want to opt out?
It's a bit like...
tell us on the national database.
Yeah, okay. And you'll be caught by the fundraising preference service as well, which is a similar thing, isn't it? You know, you don't know about it unless somebody says they want to opt out of receiving fundraising information from your hospice if you've got a charity.
We're registered for that, and that's not a problem. I mean, we've never had anyone want to come out of it, so every week we get the alert that says you have zero requests to come out, so that's quite nice. But you can't even log into the tool without having that registration detail. And they're telling me I don't need to have that registration detail until I know that I've got somebody who wants to come out.
Yeah, it's
seems
great.
Slightly,
isn't it?
Slightly obtuse, but
it's well
weird.
Thought through.
Yeah, it's probably another one of those NHS well thought through processes that they'll mop us all up at the end, us little separate organisations that sit outside of the main body.
Yeah, and have you seen that new, a couple of months old, you'll probably have, the templated data sharing agreement that NHSX have published?
Yes, I have. I haven't compared it to what we've already got, but that's another piece of work just to make sure that we're covering all the bases. But one of the things I find about the DSP toolkit, it's very thorough.
Mm-hmm.
And it is actually all very best practice.
Yeah.
So I can understand why we need to do it. It's just getting the processes right in the first place. We've been following it since 2009, so we're fairly embedded. But I feel sorry for smaller, younger organisations that fall into it, because actually it is a bit, it's hard work. It's hard graft to start off with, getting all your policies and procedures in place.
Yeah.
It's a handy thing to do because it keeps you doing the right things and keeps you the right side of the law in a way.
And you'll have had the old toolkit to complete, which I have to say I didn't think was very good. The old toolkit, I thought it was a bit too.
No, I was doing that for years. Yeah, I was doing that for years. The new toolkit is much shorter and much simpler for smaller organisations like ours. Mm. But interestingly. You find your standards slipping slightly, because we had to actually meet very high standards when we were doing the original one. We were audited at one point, just out of the blue. We've struggled to keep up with the training, bizarrely. Keeping everybody, because they want 95% compliance, which doesn't sound massive when you've only got 200 staff. But actually, that's quite tricky when some of them are furloughed.
Have you got volunteers as well?
We've got about 600 volunteers, and then trying to keep up with all of that, keep up with the department lead, saying, look, you know, you need to make sure that that person who shakes a bucket once a year for you has had a briefing paper at least.
Yeah.
You know, that they're your sort of little pockets of danger area that cause you the headaches, actually.
Yeah, we support an air ambulance charity, and they get exactly the same thing. You know, tracking down all their volunteers. You know, some of them are, no disrespect to them, old people. You know, working in shops, charitable shops, and you know, so they haven't deployed e-learning because they just can't get people to do it.
No, and we've got e-learning, and even with e-learning, it's really problematic because you do get groups of people that haven't used computers, aren't computer literate. We decided to move away from classroom training, and I think actually we should have some available for those people and just do those mop-ups, really.
Forces,
and that would keep us nearer. I think that would keep us nearer the 95% mark. But yeah, that's a bit of a constant battle. So what we've said to people is, sadly, when you return after lockdown and all of those things and come back to volunteering, you can't do that unless your Staten Man, including IG, is up to date.
Yeah.
So that, you know, they shouldn't be allowed in the door going forward. So hopefully we'll then start to be able to keep those numbers raised.
Yes.
But yeah, the volunteer sector side was has always been problematic for us.
Yeah. Tracy, just a point here. I realised that we're recording this. So if you don't want, and it's probably a good idea if we only talk to Miles here, publish the bit that is our consultants talking rather than this type of discussion or questions from...
Yeah, no, that's fine.
Participants. I'm not sure. You never, because I don't want anybody to feel inhibited what they could talk about. Oh, better not say that. Oh, I think we should probably, as a kind of a rule of thumb, say that we'll record the bit that we're doing, and then if anybody else wants to kind of come on the thing, we won't record that, or we'll certainly chop it off any published recordings.
Yeah,
that's probably the best approach.
Rick's got some... a question as well. He wants to share.
I'm sorry to cut you off, Tracy.
No, that's absolutely fine.
That's great, but thank you for raising that. Rick wanted to share a conversation with the ICO regarding cybersecurity tools. Rick, do you want to elaborate?
Yeah, it was just because we had a whole host of cyber tools that we're pushing specifically for things like your antivirus, your malware, your email security, all the data loss prevention stuff. And as the list got bigger and bigger and bigger, I was making sure that, do we have DPIs for all these applications? And because, patient data is flowing through everything that we do. So then I was pushing to say that, okay, does that then mean we need an Article 9 condition for every single one of these tools because they see that data? I just wanted to share that, the ICO was saying that although, data is processed by all of those applications, they don't see it as processing of special category data, so therefore it doesn't need that condition. So that was just something that I've been pulling my hair out for ages, so just thought I'd share it.
Oh, right. Yeah, okay, then.
I've come across something like this, Rick, to be honest, just recently. I think, and I mean, feel free to jump in if you feel otherwise, but that generally in terms of things like this, sort of like technical processes which are handling data technically but sort of only on a very technical level, that we're categorizing them more as recipients than actual processes. That's the sort of approach that I've seen taken. I'm currently undertaking a supplier review for one of my clients in the IT department. We've had a little bit of friction, let's say, because I like to include a lot of these suppliers as processes, at least for assurance purposes, but they're saying, no, they don't handle any data. It just simply passes through because they're infrastructure, for instance.
Yeah.
But then
and
we've
therefore,
got
that's not a processor.
I was just thinking the likes of SolarWinds.
Exactly.
There is still a potential for loss.
No, absolutely. And this was sort of my broader point, is I was quite reluctant to take that approach because even if you're not directly processing, if that supply is taken out in some capacity, that's still going to affect your availability. That's still... has the potential to completely disrupt your system. So I'm very reluctant to take the approach that just because there are a recipient rather than actual process within the meaning of the law, that we're going to exclude them from our risk assessment processes. But it's certainly an interesting conversation to have.
Interesting. Now, I feel that we've probably run out of time. I think we probably could carry on all afternoon as usual. I don't think we should. So what do you think, Ollie? I know everyone's kind of, it's good to actually get people on talking because we often don't get that when we're doing a bigger session. It's great to have people coming on talking to us actually. Should we call it a day to think, or should we, anything else we need to cover off?
I think that's probably more or less it from my end, certainly in terms of things that I've seen this week. Obviously, if there are any more sort of questions from the guys on the call that we can have a chat about, then by all means. But otherwise, yeah, I think that's probably going to be it for me for this week.
Yeah, okay, good. Next week we're spending half a day doing a data purge, going through a lot of our records and purging them out of our Salesforce system, which that'd be interesting. Quite looking forward to doing that actually. And I'm speaking at a housing conference in June, I think, and I'm being badgered to prepare and tell them what I'm talking about. I think I'm going to talk about this new housing code of conduct that we're working on. So a code of conduct for the housing sector, which would be interesting. It's been quite good fun to do that, you know, working through the Article 42 code of conduct kind of provisions and putting together something for that sector. Maybe we'll do it for other sectors as well, but it's been quite instructive getting the National Housing Federation involved and some other third parties as well. So anyway, listen, I think we'll probably call it a day. So I don't know whether anyone's got any feedback. Happy to kind of take your feedback, whether this is a useful session or too woolly, but you know, we not sure that it's, you know, always a good idea to have a topic to really drill into. And, you know, we thought we'd try this kind of more free ranging discussion. And it's been good because we've had a couple of people come on with specific questions. But I would like to thank you all very much for joining us. It's been great to have you on board. I hope your shoulder improves, Rick. I hope mine improves as well. And I hope everyone has a good weekend. And next week, I don't know what we're talking about. Miles, what we're talking about next week?
Next week we've got we've got requests for information, so we've got a discussion about the EIR.
Oh right, yeah, yeah, we're doing freedom of information, yeah, environmental information regulations, and that'd be interesting to talk through that. So that's what we're doing next week. In the meantime, have a great weekend, everyone. Have a good start next week, and hopefully we'll catch you with you next Friday afternoon. And thank you very much, Ollie. Thanks for joining, and thanks, Miles, for organising.